Today is Wednesday. It's August 25th, 2021. It's 1:41 in the afternoon. And hi again, this is John Williams. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. And remember, you can listen to me weekdays from 9 to noon on WGN Radio.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Brandon Poe from WCIU and Ebony Magazine.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Eric Zorn, the spirited pundit at large.
Eric, why are you spirited?
Well, last week I tried to rehabilitate the word feisty, if you remember. And one of our listeners, Rick Lightburn, wrote in and said that he disagreed with me. He thought that the word feisty is automatically sexist and you can't use it. So he suggested that I use spirited instead. So in honor of our listener, Rick Lightburn, I'm spirited this week.
That'll play better in your household, too, because I believe the conversation came up because your wife corrected you, right?
Yes, I think I was describing Susana Mendoza in a very fond way. And she said, "You would never say that about a man," and I tried to disagree, but I have lost that, so I'm moving on.
And I think language is a fungible thing. You got to go with the times. You know, what's in and what's out, what you can and can't say. There's examples in the news every week of people that are either burned for something they said and they deserve it, or some nuance they didn't appreciate, Eric. I don't think feisty is going to get you in big trouble, but okay. Spirited, right?
I've already started the petition.
Did you hear that Eric Zorn, in a tweet that we dug up from 7 years ago, described someone as feisty? Holy cow, he can't be on the podcast.
I'm going to be dogpiled on Twitter now.
I'm telling you.
I've got the hashtag ready. Cancel Eric Zorn. It's done.
I already own it, so don't even start. Hey, listen, on another Zoom screen is Sarah Tiemann. She's the marketing manager at WGN Radio. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, John.
Hey, Sarah.
So, hi, everyone.
Just for a second, I asked Sarah to jump on here in the beginning of the pod this week to tell the Mincing Rascals listeners what the Thomas Jefferson listeners probably already know. I interview frequently Thomas Jefferson on stage a couple times a year. We took a hiatus for the last year and a half. We're going to talk to him. What's the schedule now on this, Sarah?
The show is Saturday, October 30th. The day before Halloween, so a very easy day to remember, and it's going to be at the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove. And traditionally, it's just you and Thomas Jefferson on stage speaking unscripted, but this year, we have a very special guest before the show, and that is the Mincing Rascals.
Yay!
Buy your ticket to see Thomas Jefferson, and you get a special bonus of the Mincing Rascals live. They will go on stage at 10 a.m. and then our presentation of Thomas Jefferson with John Williams will follow.
So we'll do an abridged version of the Mincing Rascals for about a half an hour. And then Thomas Jefferson comes onto the stage. The Rascals exit. Wait till you see this unscripted conversation we have with Thomas Jefferson. It's very funny, very informative. Makes you appreciate America and its principles again. If you ever thought, boy, I'd sure like to ask one of the founding fathers how they feel about X, this is that.
Yep, 10 a.m. Right? Doors will open probably about by 9:45 or so. So you can just come in when you arrive. Even if you get there at 10:05, you're welcome to come right in, sit down and listen to the Mincing Rascals. And we'll go on sale with tickets. And all information can be found on WGNradio.com/TJ. And that should go on sale on Tuesday. That is Tuesday, August 31st.
And that's $33, right?
Correct. Yes. 33 WGNradio.com/TJ, Saturday, October 30th, Tivoli Theater, Downers Grove, assigned seating.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
That's a Sarah Tiemann, the marketing manager at WGN Radio. On Mondays, when you hear the number of weekend shootings in Chicago, remember this. The city does not include expressway shootings in its shooting statistics. Those are state-controlled numbers, even if they're downtown on one of our major expressways. About that, we've had 158 such shootings this year. Already 30 more than all of last year, and nearly triple the number we had in 2019, 158, and here it is still August. So now license plate reading cameras are going to be installed on area expressways to either deter or catch those shooters, not to catch the speeders or issue them tickets, by the way. But Eric, in general, are you optimistic about this?
Well, it seems like a necessary step to take to try to deter this crime, but it just seems to be hitting people in such a random way. There have been stories about, like, there was a woman who was like a Sunday school teacher or something like that. Just, I mean, these aren't gang members shooting at each other. These are people who are out there shooting at random strangers. And I don't even understand that crime. I don't see what people have in it. Is it an initiation ritual or something? I have no idea what is prompting this, why it's worth the risk that people are undergoing to do this. But boy, they've got to do something to crack down on it. And this seems like at least one thing they can do.
I think some of them are road ragers. Brandon, what are you thinking about this, Brandon?
Chicago's the only city I've ever heard of anything like this before. Highway shootings and to be so prevalent. You got to do whatever you have to do. So if they have to screen license plates, you got to do that. People have concerns, obviously, with privacy. People don't really like license plate readers, but there's no excuse to not even be safe driving down the expressway.
Yeah.
And the victims are people who aren't involved in these conflicts. Lisa. Children, women, men, who they're not part of gangs, right? It's spilling out. This is a true crisis, and there's lots of different factors possibly for it, but right now we have to do what we can to combat it. So I'm in favor of whatever ways we can. If tracking down these people through license plates is going to do it, okay, but I'm not quite sure where that connection is. You really can crack down via just license plate readers. That's my immediate concern, but we got to try whatever we can. It almost feels like throwing stuff at the wall and seeing if it sticks, you know?
Well, I'll be interested to see the technology and see whether it really captures these license plates. These folks are usually moving at speeds of 90 miles per hour. Some of this is road rage. Some of it is gang stuff. And when you've got a shooter behind the wheel driving at, you know, 85, 90 miles per hour, these folks are even worse shots. I mean, and so innocent people are being killed. To Brandon's point, I think we have to try anything we can. I have family and friends saying, well, when I come in, they know about it. Should I avoid this highway or this interstate?
Well, it's interesting because you have it triple the number of these incidents from 2019. There can't be triple the number of just pure road rage incidents. Road rage certainly accounts for some of these, but there's some other explanation that we're not getting at that is causing this mm-hmm. increase. And we're also seeing, I think there's been more than 1,000 carjackings in the city since the beginning of the year, which is, we're not the only place in the country that's seeing this surge in carjackings, but that's a huge problem. And I don't know how well license plate readers can help solve that problem, but boy, they have to figure something out, because if you get people who are afraid to leave their houses, afraid to drive on city streets, afraid to drive on expressways, you're going to get the kind of exodus from the city that is really going to be crippling for employers and residents. So this is not, I mean, it's a huge problem that it could be turning to something far worse.
I'm curious just on the, and I agree with Lisa. I've heard from people who I wouldn't normally think of as like knee jerk scared people about coming into Chicago for other reasons, saying, I don't take the expressways anymore. And it is hard to plan. That's almost what, like close to one a day, one every 2 days on the expressway. That's crazy. And I think for the technology, on the technology piece, it's just really, really important that the city sets sunset dates and some kind of guardrails around what that technology is used for and when it's evaluated and who it's evaluated by. We just saw this with ShotSpotter. The Inspector General's office put out a huge report basically saying, we knew before this report, but Chicago's ShotSpotter's biggest customer, we've spent tens of millions of dollars on this technology, and it's not really leading to great evidence for fighting or solving crimes. And it's also changing police behavior in ways that are unexpected and not helpful. So with any new technology that's for crime fighting, you just need to make sure that it's not, you don't set it and forget it. You need to constantly monitor it and axe it if it's not working.
One thing that's really struck me, I still think about the little girl who was shot in the McDonald's drive-thru and all these different cases of children caught in the crossfire, oftentimes while just driving down an expressway or just driving through Chicago. It is unheard of. And in talking with current, I'll say, gang affiliated people now and those who were gang affiliated back in the day, the biggest thing I hear from those who were gang affiliated back in the day in Chicago, let's say 90s, early 2000s, there used to be a code. There used to be a line. There also used to be a little bit more organization with these gangs as well. So you didn't see as much of this. Well, now that's unheard of. Now there's no organization. Now there's multiple factions that spill off, and these factions war with each other. You can't even name all the factions anymore because a new one crops up almost every year. You know, it used to be just the GDs and a few others. Now it's probably a good 20, 30 different little factions out here. And without really having a tracking of who is where and all this type of stuff, new organization. And now that code and that barrier is gone. This whole code that used to exist of women and children, you know, not shooting into crowds, things like that. That code it's not there anymore. And so we have an empathy crisis. That's really what it comes down to. People just don't care anymore. In the end, license plate readers probably aren't going to do much for that. We still got to attack the root. But as long as we don't, sadly, we're going to keep seeing sad stuff like this happen. Like you said, Eric, it's a very interesting point. We're going to see an exodus of Chicagoans in mass if this keeps up.
To Austin, is it your read that the video will be matched with, like, you'll have to have something that hears the gunshot, and then they go check the video at the time that the gunshot took place, and then they look at all of those license plates, and then how do they know which car it was that was firing the gun?
My understanding of the license plate reader would be more like you can easily account for every car that's passing through different parts of the highway at any time. So if you know shots were fired at this location, you can look at maybe three overpasses back at which cars were passing through there.
Right.
Perhaps.
Okay.
That would be my understanding.
And then you've got all those license plates
detecting shots like ShotSpotter.
But then you've got all those license plates. Now you got to knock on doors or call these people up. And by the way, the shooter was probably in a stolen vehicle. So you might find a stolen car, but you might not even find the shooter, right?
Are most of these shootings happening from other cars on expressways or from overpasses onto cars?
My read is
my
car
understanding
to car.
Is the former.
Car, oh, okay. Car, but you guys.
Other vehicles.
You think it's other vehicles, Lisa?
By and large, yes.
Yeah, I don't think this is a sniper situation. I think that would be even more alarming than we've got now. Yeah. It's, you know, to circle back to what Austin was saying about the privacy concerns of this, it is a concern, obviously, but everybody I know carries around with them a tracking device, a searchable tracking device in their phone, so that if you get implicated in some crime, they can check your phone records and your location records and find out where you were. Also, a lot of us have this Easy Pass or iPass that whenever you go through a toll detector, it tells where your car is and so on. So the idea that they can't follow you around, we need to get rid of these records as soon as possible is compelling, but I'm not sure how much it's going to make them a difference in terms of their ability to find people. I think from what I understand that this is exactly how this works. It's going to be kind of like those open road tolling areas where they just keep track of every car. You might well have a description of the car so it could narrow it down so it's not just one of 500 cars that went under the detector at any given time. Again, it doesn't seem like it's going to solve this problem, but it may reduce it. I don't know what would. It seems like unless you have really severe penalties, additional penalties for people who do this, it's probably not going to make that much of a difference.
It's not really expensive. That was the other thing. It was I don't know if that $12 million grant covers it completely, but it didn't strike me as being that novel or expensive, and I'm wondering what took them so long. And Austin, I appreciate your sunset comment, but to be honest with you, what's the harm in this thing? I'm not real optimistic about it, but I even want them to go after speeders. They're not even going to check for speeds. I don't want you to get people doing 75, but I do want you, if you could tell with those cameras someone's doing 100, mail them a ticket.
Whenever you are hoovering up people's data indiscriminately, that presents lots of privacy and security risks for people. We already saw this with the vax passport stuff at the state of Illinois. The state of Illinois and the city of Chicago and Cook County are not great at people keeping people's private records private. And that's a legit concern, and that's a trade-off that you have to weigh whenever you're creating a whole new sort of dragnet of people's data.
I don't mean to be naive here, Austin, but tell me what the worst case scenario is of you knew I was on the Eisenhower at 2:30.
I believe it's going to show up in a number of different criminal cases. Here was this guy robbed a bank, and now suddenly there's a slippery slope. I'm not saying that's wrong.
But I didn't rob the bank. Wait a minute. No. I'm driving down the highway, and you know that I'm driving down the highway. And if that technology helps deter or catch criminals, I'm willing to trade that amount of information, because all I'm doing is driving down the highway. Well, so,
John, if you're on your way to an assignation with your mistress, this could be used against you in a divorce case. And this has happened, that they use these kind of toll records in divorce cases. And that to me is a bad case scenario.
What's the prize here, Eric? What's the prize? The prize is maybe this will cut down on the shootings. So are you willing to trade one for the other, the prospect of one for the other?
I would say, I'm not sure what the question is exactly, but I would be in favor of, even though I know we all carry around phones and all that other stuff, I'm still in favor of them saying, okay, we will erase these records after 5 days or whatever.
Me too.
Just for, to make people more comfortable with the idea. Furthermore, we have these other cameras. We have a lot of cameras on the streets. We have front door cameras. We have cameras monitoring. So you might be able to track a vehicle off the highway onto a city street into a neighborhood. You might be able to zero in on some suspects that way too.
That's a good point.
And of course, finally, it's the kind of technology that might exonerate someone who was falsely accused. So there's that possibility too. So
have any of you ever seen a state police car going down any of these highways? I mean, where I'm not blaming them. They may be short staffed and all this other stuff, but where are the patrols? I mean, just to kind of catch people going 100 million miles an hour and causing wrecks and that kind of thing, just to sort of bring some civility back to driving on the highway.
I don't see them either. When I'm driving back from Ohio, you see cops everywhere, Ohio, Indiana. You get to Chicago, I don't see them at all. And you can just, it's a free-for-all. You can go as fast as you want. isn't Lakeshore Drive, I'm sorry, John Baptiste, DuSable, Lakeshore Drive, isn't that speed limit like 45 miles per hour and no one goes 45?
I was on it this morning. I noticed up by North, it's 40. And I was doing 60, and I was not even competitive. I was doing, of course you're doing 60. I mean, because you can do 60, but people are doing 75 at 6:30 in the morning. There's no trouble.
Yeah, I don't want to be called grandma by somebody zooming by me. I got to keep up. So.
Well, no, the most dangerous thing you can do is not go with the pace of everybody else. And that's the thing with all of the cameras we have and all of the storefront cameras, all the private cameras, all the city cameras in the city. It's like these veins going right through town. There's no cameras there. Why did it take them this long to do this?
I would go along with those cameras being used to catch people who are going like 20 miles an hour over the speed limit or more, because I think people are worried that it's going to end up like Chicago, where they're nailing people for going 6 miles an hour over the limit.
I know. Listen to us. We hate that.
We hate that. But
I've already paid that ticket.
But again, that's not terribly dangerous. When you're driving on the Dan Ryan, and I drive a lot coming back from Ann Arbor, you get people who are going literally 90 miles an hour. I mean, I'm going about the speed limit, maybe at 60, something like that. And people are just weaving in and out. It's like, it's fun for them. And there's no, you don't want the cops to chase them, because that would be extremely dangerous. So everyone just goes, well, what are you going to do? Well, maybe this is what you do. Maybe you get them and then you impose severe fines on someone like that. Yeah. I don't know. But that's, I wouldn't mind it if it's being used to address a real problem like that. And I think that is a real problem.
Austin, have we convinced you cameras good?
I don't know. You might have to go with that Ben Franklin quote about like liberty and security. People who trade their liberty for a little security deserve neither. Ben would say.
City workers have to get vaxxed. Kids have to wear masks. Here's just an update on COVID-19 in Chicago. Jesse and Jacqueline Jackson are in the hospital with COVID-19. He was and she was not vaccinated. 40-plus Illinois schools may currently be in defiance of the governor's mask mandate. positivity rate statewide is 5.3%, and 53% of the population in the state is fully vaccinated. All our major hospitals are requiring the staffs to be vaccinated, but Northwestern's giving their employees two more months to get it done. Delta Airlines is charging its unvaccinated employees an extra $200 a month for health care coverage. And one last note, the infection rate is now higher for children than it is for adults. What jumps out at you with all of that there?
That the East Bank Club is looking for an exemption to the mask mandate because they're requiring vaccinations.
What's the premise for that? If you're a health club, you're an indoor space. I would imagine you'd have to be masked up like everybody else. They don't want
because they're requiring vaccinations for staff and patrons.
Oh. I would say if people are vaccinated, then I would go along with the East Bank Club's, especially if they'd give me a free membership.
I'm not talking about East Bank Club, but I don't know that I trust people generally to you know, say I'd want to be part of something like that. I would encourage that business to a business to sort of say, no mask mandate. Cause I don't trust that people will follow those
rules. I get your point. Any of these places that say you have to be vaccinated. And if not, we need you to wear a mask, which is what the state of Montana has for its hospitals. You cannot have a law in Montana mandating vaccinations, with the exception of the hospitals. And in the hospitals in Montana, they say, if you're vaxxed, you don't have to wear a mask. If you're not vaxxed, we'd ask you to wear a mask. Okay, everybody, honor system, you know, and promise me you'll be good.
I think for employers, it's probably easier to enforce because you basically just say, you know, just like everybody gives you their, you know, W-9 or whatever, give us your vax card and we'll keep it on file. I do think there are a lot of government contexts where it is important to have all employees vaccinated. And I think of those jobs similar to like the military, where you don't really have a choice in certain things about your job. If 80% of people at the Illinois Department of Corrections aren't vaccinated and COVID rips through a corrections facility, that's a huge public safety risk for the rest of the state. So I think in some context, it makes sense, even from the government side, to mandate it for employees. On the private side, similarly, like these contexts like nursing homes, it would make sense to have a vaccination mandate for being able to work there because that's about your quality of service to the people that you're serving in that industry. But I think what we're going to see now is where the rubber meets the road on public sector unions and the Pritzker administration for the first time on a really big issue. It's happening on the energy debate right now, where Pritzker is really pushing to close down a lot of these plants that provide union jobs. And it's going to happen on vax mandates for folks in AFSCME and SEIU and other unions. And they're already pushing back very heavily.
Yeah, well, AFSCME and the Chicago Federation of Labor both come out against vaccine mandates. They call them punitive. And of course, the Fraternal Order of Police spokesman John Catanzara never disappoints. He said, we're in America. God damn it. We don't want to be forced to do anything, period. This ain't Nazi effing Germany. So this is where our union movement is on this, which I
No,
find,
that's where Catanzara is on that.
Well, yes.
He was elected by a majority of the rank and file.
I doubt that most of the cops would second that language or that emotion.
Well, the language, but certainly AFSCME and CFL. Is SEIU also? Have they also come out against the?
I might be overstepping on SEIU, but I think in general, if you're a large public sector labor union in Illinois, this is not something you've been pushing for at all.
Yeah, and this just enrages me. I feel like these unions, these public sector employees, these are people who are routinely in contact with the public or in contact with people who are routinely in contact with the public. This is how we're going to beat back this pandemic, is we're going to through mass vaccinations, and these unions sticking up for people who through stubbornness or ignorance refuse to get vaccinated, they are perpetuating the problem. There's this stories come out about these DJs who these conservative DJs who've been railing against the vaccine who died in August. Dick Farrell in West Palm Beach, Phil Valentine in Nashville, and Bible prophecy teacher, Dr. Jimmy DeYoung Sr. in Chattanooga. They all died in August of COVID. And they were all people who were railing against the vaccine. And I have no sympathy for them in this. I have no, not a single part of my heart is melted by their deaths, because these are people who are willing for their own selfish purposes to not get vaccinated, to keep this virus going, that's filling up our intensive care units, that's putting children in the hospital because they, for some stupid reason, won't get vaccinated. I mean, my patience has just expired on this, and my sympathies have expired as well.
I'm all for a mandate. I think at this point, the biggest concern the city and cities need to worry about is the ICU beds and overstuffing these hospitals. Our healthcare system overall is just not fit to handle this type of, you know, public health crisis the way it is, as is right now. Vaccinations obviously limit hospitalizations, limit death. And people have other ailments. They have things they have to go to the ICU all the time for that aren't COVID, but there are people being turned away from getting treated for those ailments because these ICU beds are filled with people that are unvaccinated getting COVID. So if you are in regular contact as a city worker with people all the time, you need to be vaccinated. I have nothing wrong with that. If you are someone who works in a hospital, I think it's a no-brainer, or working in an emergency transport. I saw a great story on ABC. They were talking, I think it was actually Montana. They were talking to different emergency, like ER services that, you know, get people, ambulance services. And they polled the people who are doing the transport, and only 60% of them were vaccinated with all the exposure they have to people with COVID. If you got to do a mandate to get people on board, get people on board, because this is really, it's not just about us and your personal feelings about it. It really is a public thing. And I, you know, to anyone pushing back, hey, did you not have to get immunizations when you had to go to kindergarten? We all did. Did you fight really hard against that? No, you didn't. You went to kindergarten, you ate your chicken nuggets because you got your immunization shot. We all had to do it at some point. If you travel anywhere outside the country, got to go to Africa or wherever, you got to get shots. It's just the way it is. So people can stop being babies about it. Get the shot.
On the ICU bed point, this is something that's interesting, because Lightfoot's getting asked about, okay, the ICU beds are getting, there's less availability, but there are 1,100 ICU beds in Chicago. Less than 100 of those are currently taken up by COVID patients. And that raises the question of, why aren't we drastically increasing the flex capacity of ICU beds in Illinois after going through this for 18 months? We still have like relatively similar stock of total ICU beds, even though we know there's going to be more waves of this. So I think the state and the city need to look a lot more critically. It doesn't necessarily look like turning McCormick Place into a hospital, but what's our flex capacity for ICU beds? Because if you're going up, it's, I believe it's like 80 to 85% of ICU beds are full right now, but only like 8 to 10% of those are COVID patients. If with a few hundred COVID patients you're totally beyond capacity, you need to think about getting more ICU beds available.
I saw a cartoon this week. My wife showed it to me, and it was of a mother and a little girl. And the mother had that little pockmark on her shoulder that a lot of us have, and we got inoculated as kids. And the little girl says, "Mom, what's that?" And she says, "That's an inoculation I got when I was a child." And the little girl says, "Well, why don't I have that?" And the mother says, "Because it worked." The language was kind of tortured, too, I thought, guys, about what's the city union employees? Who are they? Is that SEIU?
CFL, Chicago Federation of Labor, that, or AFSCME is public employees also for the state mostly.
And it was one of them, Eric, but it was this, you know, group that represents the 30,000 city employees that now have to get vaccinated. And they said something like, "We believe in the vaccinations. They're good. Everybody should get vaccinated. We do not want you to tell us to get vaccinated." I don't know how you do that.
It's not possible. that's a tough tightrope to walk right there.
Yeah.
I saw that statement. I think what you're trying to do is appease feelings. People like to feel, for some reason, they're really entrenched in this idea of personal liberty and not publicly being a part of a team. They're trying to appease those feelings. You can't win with that.
This is small potatoes compared to them big potatoes, but the Park District Superintendent Michael Kelly, and also what's happening with those Amazon boxes in the parks.
BEZ has done most of the great coverage, WBEZ, on this scandal at the Park District. That's Superintendent Michael Kelly, and you know, the problem has come up with reports of sexual abuse and substance abuse on the job for lifeguards at Oak Street Beach, and Kelly was slow to initiate the investigations, and then he recently suspended Nathan Kipp, the deputy inspector general in charge of this investigation, and Kipp issued a statement saying his suspension was an attempt to whitewash the investigation. So this is not looking good for Kelly. It's not looking good for the city, for the Park District's response to this. At the same time, there's this much more minor issue of these 100 or so Amazon hub lockers that were placed into the parks around the city. And I forget the total amount of money that they were going to realize from this, but it was, Lisa, do you remember what, how much money it was? It was not, it was like, was it 100?
It was 100, it was like $137,000. It was a terrible, it's a terrible deal for the city.
Which would probably pay for one superintendent in one park for 1 year. I mean, it's and they're ugly, commercializing the parks. You know, I mean, you want them to be thrifty and run a good business, but this seems like another, just a misstep on the Park District's part.
They're now looking to sort of redo all of these park buildings or a lot of these different park buildings, and it's going to cost millions and millions. And Amazon is doing pretty well. I wonder what kind of analysis went into where to locate these, because you definitely don't put it on a sidewalk. An analysis, a financial analysis. The Park District needs money, or they say they need money. I don't know. It just seems like that seems really low.
I think what they did, Lisa, was they called up the people that did the Skyway deal and the parking meters. And they said, hey, what have you got? And they said, just take whatever you can get and don't worry about it. We're good. Coffee's all the way around. Austin, what's your thought about that?
I'm not like categorically opposed to this idea, especially when you have areas of the city, especially like friends on the south side who haven't been able to get packages in the mail. Yeah. Do you guys remember that last year? That was a disaster. Yeah. People were losing
really
important
stuff. It's still happening on the north side too. We're still having problems here.
Yeah. It's and tell you what, like whatever you think of Amazon, the lockers get you the stuff quick and when they say they're going to get it to you. So I'm not necessarily opposed to having that in places that are more accessible for more Chicagoans. Now, the devil's always in the details with these deals. Like, yeah, in theory, this is good, but the city could have got a lot more money. Is it appropriate to be selling essentially like billboards for a company within the public park district? That's kind of ridiculous. Lisa's right. There's tons of improvements that need to be made to like park infrastructure that they really need the money for. The biggest problem in the park district right now is around this whole sexual assault and harassment scandal. And I think it's going to be it could end up being a massive problem for the mayor if the reporting from WBEZ is accurate, which is that this whistleblower sent the mayor what seemed to be a pretty detailed account of her sexual assault of a Chicago Park District employee. And the mayor, rather than take that to law enforcement or directly to the inspector general's office, gave that directly to Park District management, where it was promptly slow walked and seemingly buried for months and months and months.
Was it sent to the mayor, or was it sent to the Park District superintendent?
The mayor.
To the mayor. Okay, I'm sorry.
I thought it was the second allegation that went to the mayor.
Okay.
And the first allegation went to Kelly, and he.
Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry.
He assured the woman who made the fit that he was going to get it going with the inspector general, and then he didn't do that. He gave it to some deputy of his. It's all kind of a complicated mess,
right.
But it just does not reflect well on Superintendent Kelly, and Austin's right that it could easily metastasize into something that doesn't reflect at all well on the mayor. So,
well, yeah, if that report is true, it just shows a pattern. Because with Anjanette Young, same thing. We saw, we'll forward this along, and then it gets bogged down, and no one addresses it. And then we see the mayor with the Anjanette Young thing. She was like, "Oh, I didn't know about it." you did. You just passed it along. You tossed the football in a sense. And seeing that happen with a sexual assault case or a sexual misconduct case, it's disheartening if that's what really happened. So, that would be terrible.
I can imagine Scott Stantis, our former Mincing Rascal, drawing a cartoon where Mayor Lori Lightfoot is barely opening her laptop, fearful of what her email is going to show. I mean, every day it's just a house of horrors for that lady. It's no fun being a mayor. That's beside the point. But I mean, it just seems like the stuff that's in her inbox can just be colossal, complicated, and even criminal.
I mean, it feels like they need to have maybe a and I say this of a lot of our elected leaders. I'm not blaming her, but there is a fairly significant communication staff that is folks who are, you know, trying to manage message. And I'll let listeners interpret that the way they will. Perhaps they should sort of get some folks in there who are in the legal world to look at this, look at these things that are coming in, and to kind of get the ball rolling on an investigation.
A good position for that, by the way, is in city ordinance supposed to be filled, which is called a city administrator. And the city has not filled it for decades after Jane Byrne.
Really?
If anyone's interested in that, I wrote a piece in the for a Tribune op-ed page a few months ago about this position, but it does exactly what you're talking about, Lisa. It's sort of a buffer between the mayor and the operations of city government. And you could totally see someone like that being the central, the quarterback for things like this. So you don't have the mayor making decisions on where to pass a sexual assault allegation.
That's interesting, Austin. And you'd also have kind of a fall guy. That is, I gave it to the administrator oversaw it, and nothing was done. It's either another layer of opportunity for stuff to get done, or politically, it would almost give the mayor a little cover. You'd think she would embrace that.
It exactly would. And the city council, the key thing about it is the mayor nominates, but city council must approve this position. So it sort of straddles the line between the executive and the legislative branch.
I want to talk just briefly about Afghanistan. We opened the podcast last week talking about what's been happening there. And we are today a week away from the Biden administration saying that operations will be done. We will have evacuated all of the Americans out there. Not so much the translators. There's an interesting front page story in the Tribune today about a guy in Indiana who was over there in Afghanistan, and the Afghani who was the translator for his unit is still there and is trying to get out. They have some day-to-day communication now. In fact, we talked to him today, and he's rightly worried that his friend is not going to be able to get out of there. The locals know who the Afghanis were that were working with the Americans, and the Taliban will not look kindly on that, especially after the 1st of September. So this guy goes to the gate a couple of times a day. There are Americans there. He's credentialed enough to get out, but they're doing the Americans first. And the way it's playing out today is this guy doesn't get on an airplane. He will be left to the wiles of the Taliban when we leave, unless something extraordinary happens, and he won't be alone. What a shame. Our word is not our bond in parts of the world, and we're going out of our way to prove it again, aren't we?
The Biden admin, they've gotten what I think Jen Psaki said, over 70,000 Americans out. That's huge. That's a great large number in a matter of 10 days. That's amazing. Yet we still have people left behind, and both of those stories matter. Both of those are true. And that's why this is more of a gray situation than black and white, right? It's wild to see, in a sense, you've seen the right, you've seen the left kind of unify around, we got to get out of Afghanistan. And now you're kind of seeing Biden deal with kind of the aftermath of trying to get out of Afghanistan and what happens with that. And maybe people would have been more happy with a indefinite occupation on a smaller scale of Afghanistan than what we ended up getting, because it's led to this sort of disaster we have now.
Well, I have a hard time with these hard deadlines when we have kind of sort of wended our way through all of this for 20 years and then to suddenly, again, take a hard line on these deadlines when you do see, Brandon, as you said, so many people suffering. I feel like we're following this false deadline just to show that we're tough.
Yeah, I'm reluctant to second guess things like this because I'm not an expert in Afghanistan or military policy or any of these things. But people who really follow this, really know, are very much questioning the timeline issue and very much questioning how, you know, the method that we've decided to take here, taking, you know, closing Bagram Airfield first and keep it and not getting people out, you know, and so we've left a small amount of military. Now we've got to put more military in. Mm-hmm. It now looks like we're really capitulating to the Taliban. We're saying, oh yes, don't, please don't hurt us. It's amazing that so far, I don't believe any American lives have been lost in all of this in the last, since the Taliban has taken over Afghanistan. I don't think any American lives have been lost. And that's stunning, but I think Biden is very worried that on September 1st, if we're not out of there, that there are going to be bombs and fires and explosions and assassinations and so on that are going to put the blood on his hands. And he doesn't want that. He clearly seems to be very afraid of that, because otherwise you think he'd tell the Taliban, hey, pound sand, we got another, it's going to take us two more weeks. You know, screw yourselves. But he's not going to do that because I think he's really afraid of some sort of backlash like this. And it makes us look terribly weak.
When I read that story about the Taliban saying, do not extend the deadline, I wondered what they had. Who did they meet with?
The CIA director.
CIA director. I wondered. I really wondered about that. And now that this is sort of out in the open,
yeah.
It just makes me wonder whether the White House has known for days that this is what they're saying. You know, we're going to make things hard, not only for the Americans left over, but if we find out anybody who's been aiding and abetting, you know, you guys, they're going to have problems.
What I'm interested in seeing now is the fact the Biden administration's lost complete control over the messaging around this and the information. The Adam Schiff was out telling reporters yesterday he did everything short of just throw the Biden administration under mm-hmm. the bus directly. And of course, that he has tons of intelligence community ties and they're trying to cover their butts for all of this too. So you shouldn't, you know, we need to take everything he says with a grain of salt, but he is publicly saying it's very unlikely the administration is going to meet this deadline. And when you have a top Democrat saying that to the media, contradicting the president, that's a huge problem. When you have two congressmen, one Democrat, one Republican, going Rambo style to Afghanistan on a fact-finding mission, mm-hmm. because they say this, they're not getting information from the State Department, which Peter Meyer and who is the Democrat from Massachusetts, Seth Moulton. That's a huge problem. And there's tons of blame to go around for the American failures in Afghanistan, but the Biden administration abandoned Bagram Airfield. And that is the biggest, that is turning out to be the biggest mistake of all of this, it seems, is doing that a month ago and not preparing that space to get people out, because now you have to take them through, you know, the middle of a battlefield essentially to get them to an airport, whereas the United States had that other airfield secured and mm-hmm. far outside of Kabul.
Austin, it was your point last week, though. I mean, so the Biden administration is doing this poorly, but it's good that we do it, right? That is, pull out of Afghanistan. So where I was worried about the security, or I don't know what I was worried about. I was worried about the security for Americans here and elsewhere. It was never going to be pretty. It didn't have to be this ugly, but it's still a good thing that we're doing this, right? Like Biden, at least he's willing to take the heat and get it done.
Yeah. But also there's blowback for this. Like if this is what the American people associate with ending regime change wars, that's bad long term. If we're known as not keeping our promises to our allies, that's bad. So, yes, very good that we're ending U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. This is being done in a terrible way, and it seems to be getting worse by the day.
And Biden is showing his prickly side, isn't he? I mean, he really is sort of digging his heels in. I guess I knew he could be stubborn, but that's not what you think of when you think of Biden. Sometimes on the campaign trail, something would come up, maybe about his son or something, and he'd get real hostile real quick. But he's kind of displaying that side. Lisa, you got to check out. Bye, Lisa.
Yeah, I apologize. I don't mean to be rude. Bye, everyone. Thank you. It's always great to see you.
Likewise. There goes Lisa Donovan.
Lisa's priorities are all messed up.
It's too bad because
she'd rather do her job than be on the mincing wrestling.
It's too bad she's going to miss the Kanye West talk now.
you mean yay?
Well, she was, before we turned our mics on, we started recording, she was curious how you're going to pronounce it. Kanye West is changing his name. It's not going to be first, middle, or last. It's just going to be...
Well, he pronounces it Yay.
It's Yay. Yeah, Yay.
Even though his nickname is also Yeezy, right? So you think it would be Yee.
But
He's going to the court to legally change it.
To Y-E.
Just to Yay. Y-E. No last name. It reminds me of Prince. Remember when Prince tried to change his name, or did change his name legally to that symbol?
Glyph.
Yeah. It's a classic genius marketing move. Same thing with Meta World Peace and Ocho Cinco. Long list of impressive individuals. Although I love Kanye West, and I'm really mad that I can't go to the
listening party
at Soldier Field. It looks pretty great.
I'm supposedly going to be there, allegedly. We'll see. So I'm excited about that, because from what I've heard of the album, it's actually decent. But I don't know. I'm kind of surprised he would change his name. He's been on this trajectory recently that's been very much centered around remembering his mother, Donda West. The album he's got coming out is named after her. And you would think that you wouldn't want to remove the name she gave you. But hey, maybe he'll explain that. Maybe we're going to find out on Thursday why he's changing it to Ye instead of Kanye. But it makes sense. He's been called that for years. It makes better sense than some people's name changes that they end up doing. I think Diddy went from Sean John to P. Diddy to now he's Love. So, Ye at least is part of his name, right?
In the gang file, there's a clip where Kanye or Ye explains Ye.
I believe Ye is the most commonly used word in the Bible, and in the Bible it means you. So it's I'm you, I'm us. It's us. It went from being Kanye, which means the only one, to just Ye.
Brandon, I was listening to what I thought were some of the tracks from Donda, and then I was reading some comments underneath, and somebody said, "Is it okay to say this is kind of boring?" And I'm not savvy, or I listened to a lot of Kanye West stuff when my kids were buying it originally, and I thought it was fantastic. I'm a fan too, I think, and I even forgive him for his weirdness and eccentricities or whatever the mental health thing is he's going through. I think that's the whole package. But I wasn't overly impressed with what I was hearing. Have you heard the tracks?
You know, there's been multiple iterations and multiple leaks. The first few ones, I thought it was terrible. And I've been thinking most of the stuff he's made since 2016 has been terrible. 2015. From the ones I heard, though, the most recent stuff, I was impressed to a degree. But maybe it's because I have a low bar. I have a low expectation of this because he's done so bad for the past few years.
And explain to us what a listening party is, which is you buy a ticket to go to his a stadium, and he turns on his 8-track player, and you all listen to his stuff, right?
Well, you know, this is something I would never pay for.
Oh, so you're covering this, are you? Is that it?
We could say. I supposedly there's some sort of VIP list or something, and somehow I made it onto that list, but. Yeah, it's him playing stuff off his aux cord, playing rough cuts and rough drafts, and allegedly the album's going to drop on Friday, but he's been saying that for 2 months now, so maybe it never does. Maybe he goes around the country and does listening parties and charges upwards of $40, $90, $100, nets a bunch of money, and people are going to show up regardless, right?
Is he going to play like individual tracks, like a play? Here's the bass line, like they did in the Paul McCartney special. And here's the strings. We'll play just those. I think that was pretty interesting when they did that in the Paul McCartney special on Hulu.
What is it? 1, 2, 3. But I presume he'll play a track, right? And then maybe say something, and then another track, and then everybody will clap. And
the way the Atlanta one went, he showed up and he played the whole album through. He didn't say anything, but he had a performance. He had dancers. He had a choir. He had all kinds of theatrics, and he had a bungee thing that lifted him up into the air. Supposedly he's building a house, rebuilding his childhood home at Soldier Field. So there's some homage to his upbringing because he's back in Chicago. So who knows what he's got up his sleeve, but he knows how to put on a show. I just don't know what that show is going to be. And if what I heard in Atlanta is what we're going to hear on Thursday, who knows?
Austin, are you going to this thing?
No, I wish I could. I love Kanye West, and I would go to basically anything he does publicly will be somewhat interesting. You know, that like he's got such a huge platform, and his track record, you know, even, and I like some of the stuff he's done the last 2 or 3 years, but he's got one of the most stellar musical track records of anyone in the last 50 years. in my opinion. And it's great that he's back in Chicago. And I hope he does a great job.
Last time I saw him live was when he did the Sunday service here in Chicago.
I didn't go to because it was like 40 degrees and raining the whole time, right?
It did rain a little bit.
Same one?
A little drizzly. I loved it. I was skeptical going in. I was what they call a hater. It's like, oh, this isn't going to work. And it was actually pretty impressive. He didn't do anything. He just kind of directed a choir.
Yeah.
You know, choirs always sound good.
He either puts on a good show or he is a good show. And, you know, for the cost of maybe 15 Chicago Cubs seats, you can actually go see the thing.
What is the ticket to the Soldier Field? How much is it?
Well, I think originally the price is supposed to be $40, but people grabbed them up. And now you're seeing prices of like $90, $110, upwards of $500, I'm hearing. So,
and you can get Cubs tickets for $6 this week. And I'm not making that up. Hey, Brandon, always good to see and hear you on this Zoom call. Austin Berg, Eric Zorn, Lisa Donovan. I had to check out. Thanks, everybody. We're produced by Elif Garris and Ashley Byhun, and we'll drop another podcast on you guys next week.
Great.
See you.
See you guys.
Thank you, fellas. Buy me some merch, Brandon. Give me like 3 or 4 hoodies.
By the way,
sell me some money because you know those hoodies cost to like $580.
You $1,000.
All right, Austin, send me some money. I'll get you a hoodie. How about that?
I love it. Peace.
See you guys.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.